I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to be talking about great books to read. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. On the book show, as you might know, my book buddies and I are excited often about a whole range of books, and so books in all categories. Later on in the show, we have an extraordinary writer, the author of The Fame Lunches, Daphne Merkin, former contributing editor to The New Yorker magazine and Elle. And so my book buddies are here. We've got these recommendations. We have Roxanne Cody of R.J. Julia Booksellers in Madison, Connecticut, Rose Quiello, who teaches literature and medicine at Quinnipiac University. We have Lee Jacobus, author of college textbooks and the short story collection Hawaiian Tales. And we have Pat Towers on the line with us. Pat is by phone. Pat is a founding editor of Vanity Fair and the weekly magazine 7 Days. She's held many highly regarded positions in book publishing and journalism, including Harcourt, Mirabella, Elle, the Oprah Magazine. She was editor at the New York Times Book Review, and it's always such a treat to have her on the show. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Faith.
So what do you have? You want to start us off?
Sure.
Okay.
I will start you off. I just finished this book last week. It's an amazing book, the most powerful book I've read in a very long time. It's by Atticus Lish, and it's called Preparation for the Next Life. This is a love story, really, and a lot of other things, too, but let's say at heart it's a love story between a veteran of the Iraq War, Skinner, who's suffering from PTSD, and the center of the book is a small, strong Chinese Muslim young woman who has made it to the United States, somehow coming through Mexico. She's an undocumented immigrant. And these two people, two unlikely people, struggling each in their own way, meet each other. And first of all, the writing is incredible. I was thinking about what to say about this book because it's quite devastating in many ways, but it has these wonderful bright, it's so alive, it's so vital. It takes place mostly in Flushing, Queens. And so this mass of people that mostly are not written about, you know, the people who've come from all over the world who have crowded into this place, and Chinese and Indian, and these two people who are sort of at the bottom trying to make their way in the world. He's trying to come back from this terrible situation in Iraq, and she's trying to make her way. She's undocumented. She's terrified the police are going to pick her up. But she is so strong and so hardworking and so impressive in her sense of herself and how they fall in love and how they deal with it and his rages. I was just so caught up in that book. When it came to an end, it has a two endings. I'm not going to say any more, except that at one I thought, oh, no, and then another I thought, oh, thank heaven.
Oh, that's interesting. So in preparation for the next life.
Right.
And the author, can you spell the last name for me?
L-I-S-H, Atticus Lish. He was the son of a very famous book editor, Gordon Lish, who's discovered many, many writers and so on. And
yeah.
I think Atticus Lish, I don't think he showed this book to his father at all as he was working on it. He worked on it for a number of years. And so it's very interesting that he has produced this book that is quite extraordinary. I think he's in his early 40s, and this is his debut.
Well, book clubs, I'd be racing to get that book as fast as possible from the sound of it. But, oh, Pat, thank you for that. Stay right where you are. Roxanne Cody, what do you have?
So I have that book in that perennial pile, so I'm gonna move it up. So the book I'm going to talk about is a odd book, and one that I found myself fascinated by. And the timing of the publication of it is almost extraordinary. It is a book called A Kim Jong-il Production. So it's about Kim Jong, who's the father of the current dictator of North Korea. So Kim Jong was a wild film enthusiast. I mean, extraordinary. And he would arrange to get all these films into North Korea so we could see them. But he wanted North Korea to – this is true. This is not this isn't fiction. He wanted to establish Korea as a towering country of film production. So he did what any good dictator would do. He arranged to have kidnapped the premier film producer in South Korea and his wife, and kidnapped them and brought them to North Korea, where they stayed for a very long time until they escaped. I mean, like decades.
I'm just, my jaw's
so
hanging open.
I'm making light of all of this because he is a kind of a cartoon character. I mean, in real life, not in the way this is written. And the film producers who are now captive in North Korea, also their egos are kind of attracted to this. And they actually go on a tour at some point. You know, so they're being watched by, you know, henchmen all the time. So what's crazy about this is this book came out right after all the Sony stuff.
Mm.
Now, Kim Jong is dead, but yeah. Little Kim Jong is still there. So I found myself, you know, I don't know that it's brilliantly written, and I don't know that it's necessarily what I thought I'd be interested in, but I was curious enough to read the book.
Yeah, and in the author is, how does the author know all this? Do you remember what?
I don't.
What the author does for a living or?
No.
Okay.
And he's not a man I ever heard of, Paul Fisher, F-I-S-C-H-E-R. And it's a new book from Flatiron Publishing. So the title is Kim Jong Il, I-L, Production.
Oh, wow. 203-776-9677 here on the book show, whether you're an individual reader, whether you are a member of a book club, we just love to hear from you about books that you recommend. 203-776-9677. Let's go to Tina. Welcome to the show, Tina.
Hi.
Hi.
So I would like to recommend a memoir that I read recently by Linda Coleman, which is called Radical Descent. And it's an amazing story from the early 70s, late 60s of Linda's joining a revolutionary group in Maine, and then finding going through her own discovery of whether she wanted to be it. You know, she wanted to fight the system as it was, but did she want to be part of a group that, in the end, became violent and robbed some banks and so on?
Oh yeah,
I see.
No. I mean, it's a familiar story because we've been through this since the Weather Underground and all that
right.
business.
So. And I think it really raises some issues. It did for me about, you know, what to do. Here we are today, and most of us have forsworn, many of us anyway, have forsworn violence, and yet here we are with a system that is, really going off the rails, and what can we do to change it or to affect any change? And so it raises a lot of those questions, mm-hmm. and it's very well written.
Right. Where is, what's civil disobedience? Where do you draw the line in civil disobedience?
Well, isn't it one man's rebel is the other man's terrorist?
Yeah.
Good point.
Well, thank you so much for calling. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. Do you want to know the publisher? I have.
No, we don't need the publisher. Okay. As long as we get the author in the title. Thank you very much, Tina.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. 203-776-9677 here on the book show. Rose Quiello, do you have something great?
Yes, I have a gem of a book by William Maxwell called So Long, See You Tomorrow. Just a little bit about Maxwell. He worked for The New Yorker for decades. And what I loved about him was he would edit John Updike, John Cheever, Eudora Welty, 3 days a week. And then he'd go home 4 days, wake up, stay in his pajamas and write. And this book, So Long, See You Tomorrow.
Sounds like such a good life. That's perfect.
This book
what
was
does in, that say about me?
Was it originally published in two parts in The New Yorker and then turned in 79 and then turned into a novel in 1980. But it takes place in Lincoln, Illinois, where a murder has occurred. And the narrator, 50 years later, is looking back, and he realizes that the father of one of his friends, his childhood friend, was the murderer who then killed himself. And 50 years later, the narrator looks back and he thinks, I could have been a better friend. And so this book is really replete with these visceral memories of grief, of I should have, could have. And it doesn't have – what I love about it, it doesn't have this moving plot. It just takes this moment, these memories, and holds them up from different angles. Very, very powerful. And it has a cumulative effect. Michael Ondaatje says, this is one of the great books of our age. William Maxwell's So Long, See You Tomorrow. Terrific. Mm. He's an understated writer. Terrific. Mm.
Wonderful book.
Wonderful.
I remember it from years ago.
Yeah.
Love that book.
I love William Maxwell so
you
much.
You do.
Me too.
I'm
you
crazy
do.
About William Maxwell. So I'm just so excited to hear you talking about that. And Pat, I hear you saying you feel the same way. Who have we got on the line? Marin, welcome to the book show.
Thank you. I'm going to talk about a book by Jon Kabat-Zinn. Wherever you go, there you are.
Okay.
It's about mindfulness, and it is absolutely fascinating. And I don't know if you know of mindfulness meditation. He also has written 10 other books, and it is not a cult. It is a way of being present and being aware and just practicing mindfulness on a daily basis whenever you want to, and it's fascinating and so beautifully written.
Yes, and Jon Kabat-Zinn comes out of a science background, and so is not one of
yes.
these woo-woo cadets who So I know exactly what you mean. And mindfulness now, I think, has leapt over that crazy zone that people wanted to put it in, as if it was like the old mm-hmm. transcendental mm-hmm. meditation, and it's now in all. Realms in society, including mm-hmm. the military and major
yeah,
corporations. And so he's an extraordinary man. I just read a Q&A with him in, and I forget what magazine, and I was so fascinated with what he had to say. Very rational, smart guy.
Well, it's
yes,
interesting. He was just on 60 Minutes, and I've read a lot of his books, and he's, sort of the grandfather, obviously, of this movement. And I was a little wary of actually hearing him speak. He's never been to the store, so I'd never met him.
Yeah.
And he only reaffirmed the appropriateness of his standing in this interview. Mm-hmm. There was everything appealing about him. He certainly didn't take himself too seriously. He didn't think it was easy. There was just everything right about him. So just... I'm glad she brought it up because it is the Bible of this movement.
Marin, do you feel, having read that, did you know about mindfulness before you read this book?
Yes, I went to I heard about it from one of my daughters, and I went to a one-day mindfulness seminar in West Hartford several weeks ago.
Okay, so you were new to it. Because I think the question was, do you have to know something about mindfulness when you read that book? And I think you're saying no.
Absolutely not. And there's also, he's written many other books, but there's another one that my daughter gave me initially called Mindfulness for Beginners. And it has a disc in it with what he calls practice mindfulness things
right.
that you can play if you want to, but you don't have to.
I know that book. Well, thank you so much, Marin. I'm so
yes.
delighted you found this, and it's made a difference in your
and
life. Thank you.
I just want to stress that it is not a cult. It is not a following of anything. It's just being aware of oneself in the present moment, and it's fascinating.
I guess I should have mentioned that mindfulness, the official title is Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. And so Jon Kabat-Zinn is the person who started that program. And the point of Marin, the great point Marin is making is that his task, as he saw it, was to take meditation and make it completely secular. That it would have mm-hmm. nothing to do with any religion. so that it could be for all people and all ages. Now it's in school systems, you know, from kindergarten straight up. It's amazing. Thank you, Marin. Good luck
to you.
May I just add, Marin, that I'm listening to it as we speak in the car.
Oh, no kidding.
On tape, okay. Yes.
All right. So, Lee Jacobus, you have a great book for us. What do you have?
Well, I just read Jane Smiley's biography of Charles Dickens, and that led me to read Charles Dickens' Barnaby Rudge, a novel I had never read
before.
And it's a fascinating a novel. It just goes on and on and on, of course, as all Dickens novels do. But the fact is that he tells you a story about one of the extraordinary revolution – well, not revolutions, but well, a kind of revolution, a rebellion that took place in London in the 1840s. And Barnaby Rudge is an idiot. And he's not an idiot savant. He's just a nice, just a nice plain idiot. And he gets caught up in this, and he becomes the leader of the rebellion. And of course, he has this raven that's always with him. Of course, and the raven is always talking to him. And it's just one of those stories that leaves you just breathless with the brilliance of the writing. I mean, Dickens just does things that nobody else can do, and he evokes the whole atmosphere of London at that time, people in the streets shooting, the guards come out and shoot the rebels, the leader, Charles Fox, who was originally in it, he winds up being in prison and gets escaped. Everything happens, and it's a wonderful story. So let me put a word in for Charles Dickens. Barnaby Rudge is wonderful, and Jane Smiley's biography, Charles Dickens, is wonderful.
Ah, great.
Two good books.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We're going to go to Pat Towers next, but first we're going to take a short break and then come right back to you with more titles to recommend. Great reads here on The Book Show. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton with a fresh edition of The Book Show, and I'd like you also to know what we're going to do on Monday on this show, this Monday. The world is such a, you don't need me to tell you this, such a chaotic, challenging place. So we'd like to give you a chance to salute someone for a kindness or an act of generosity. Or if you were the giver, please call. We just want to remind ourselves that the world is about this too. Small acts, big acts, helping with a suitcase, sitting with a lonely old person you didn't know. The goodness of ordinary people in a way. Call in this Monday at 3 on Monday on the Faith Middleton Show. It will re-air at 9 o'clock. So we're looking forward to it, and we hope you will listen and participate. This is The Book Show. I'm with Roxanne Cody, Rose Criello, Lee Jacobus, and by phone, Pat Towers. Pat, what do you have to recommend?
Well, I have a writer that I love. He writes novels and he writes short stories, and I'm going to particularly talk about the short stories. This is Jim Shepherd, who's written one collection of stories is called You Think That's Bad. Another one is called Like You'd Understand Anyway. He is a kind of amazing writer. He is funny, deadly. He has the imagination of disaster, and he goes throughout history to write about extraordinary events. He has a story about a lone soldier on Hadrian's Wall in the last days of the Roman Empire, all by himself waiting for the barbarians to attack. He does another one about the Greek playwright Aeschylus. He does a story about the Chernobyl disaster. He has an absolutely brilliant story called Minotaur, which is about a man and his wife, the narrator, who works in the black world, the secret government stuff with drones, which is a stunning little story. And it ends with the memory of this narrator's old college professor talking about unleashing the god of chaos. Mm-hmm. He has a story called The Netherlands Lives with Water, which is set sometime in the not-too-distant future, involving climate change, the Dutch being the wisest about handling water and floods. And they've always contended with great ingenuity with flooding. So he sets it there, and they've set up this intricate water defense. And the stories always are involved with not just these big disasters, but in the midst of them, a mother with Alzheimer's, a smart kid. They always come back to humans and love and family. So mixed with these great events is this very intimate sense of a person in the middle of it, or a few people. So I find them just wonderful. He's also very witty in the midst of all this. So it's both funny and deadly and witty. I recommend him highly.
Mm. And can you repeat author and title again?
Okay, Jim Shepard, S-H-E-P-A-R-D, and one title is You Think That's Bad, and the other one is Like You'd Understand Anyway. And these are both two collections of stories.
Such good titles. Oh, boy. So the quick question for you, Pat. Do you have... I find that I go through periods where I'm into novels much, much more than I am short story collections. And then I'll think, I'd like to read a short story collection. And then I'll switch over. I lean more toward the novel. Does that happen to you, or do you prefer one over the other?
Well, I'm rather drawn to short stories. I love novels, but a novel... I like the quickness of the short story, and I like the little surprise that it sort of... I think of them a little bit more like poetry. So we live such rushed lives. In some ways, I think I'd lean a little more to stories, although a good novel, there's nothing like immersing yourself in a really good novel. But they're harder to sustain. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I think there are fewer of them. I don't know.
Yeah, harder to say goodbye to.
Yes.
Also,
oh, very hard to say goodbye to a good one.
If you love the people, if you care about them, oh, so hard.
You know, one time when Amy Bloom was at the store, and I'm like Pat, I'm always drawn to short stories. And Amy Bloom at one time talked about the difference, because Amy Bloom has done both, right? She's a short story writer as well as a novelist. And she, I'm not going to do her language justice, but she talked about the challenge of attracting you to the characters quickly, and then allowing you to leave the story feeling satisfied, right? So those are big challenges to get done in what might be a real short story, meaning 10 pages, not a novella. And when I thought about it that way, the ones who do it great accomplish both those things. You're drawn right away in. And as Pat said, that element of surprise, but it feels satisfying. It's tidy.
Yeah, it's like it's being a miniaturist, whether you're doing a painting or you're a graphic designer who says, I've been asked to design a new postage stamp, you know, or you have to do a book jacket or, you know, I mean, it's just such a hard task.
It's a very difficult task. And in fact, a good short story is an exploration, but it's also a revelation. It's a revelation to the person who writes it, because in fact, most people who start a short story have no idea where they're going to go. And when they get there, they are shocked to know that they've actually reached the point where they can't go on. And that's why an awful lot of good writers really write a good short story and then don't go on to write novels. There are, you know, a few really wonderful writers who just write stories, and they have hit the point. I mean, it's an astonishing experience if you do it right.
I think of short story writers like Amy Bender and Miranda July, who I think are both insane and brilliant.
Yes.
And what they do is, you know, they do that rearrange your brain thing where you're not even really sure that you know what happened. You know, it's like being hit with a baseball. But nonetheless, I'm thrilled I read them. But they're crazy.
Yeah, that's a whole separate category right there. It's like, okay. Anyway, Pat, thank you so much for bringing that up. So I'm one of these people who are talking about stacks of books at home, and I'm one of these people who never did read Marilynne Robinson's Gilead, which has been at my stack at home. And so I picked it up, and I'm about, halfway, a little bit more than halfway through, and I like it very, very much. I know it's come up here on the book show before, but I frankly couldn't remember what anybody said, which that's probably how our listeners feel. So
right. You talked about Gilead?
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes I do feel, while I'm reading it, I can feel that sense of construction about the book as an idea, you know, the writer turns to that sense of construction where, in this case, the writer is saying, I'm writing a letter to my own son, and I know I'm not going to be alive very long. And here's, you know, and you start to tell the story of your life the next thing you know. And so it's a construction, and a writer has to have one, especially in this age. So, but what matters in the end most for me is how much this book gets me to care, and this one really does. She's done that in a major way. I care very much about this man who's narrating, and the kinds of things that he's explaining to his own son make me appreciate those twists in every life, and the things, the journey that it is, and what we regret, and how candid he chooses to be, and how honest he can be with himself. You can see him bargaining with himself and yet trying to keep the greater purpose of his son's life in mind. And there's a kind of dignity and nobility about this narrator that I just adore. A man who's got a fine moral sense and a really, just really, really like it so much. And it's out in paperback. So it's Gilead, G-I-L-E-A-D, and a book that is well worth your time. Okay, 203-776-9677. Some of my book buddies are going to stay. Some are going to dash. Pat, I leave it to you. In our next segment, I'm going to be interviewing Daphne Merkin, whose book is called The Fame Lunches. Oh, what a book this is. So stay with us if you're listening, and we'll be right back. Faith Middleton, this is a fresh edition of The Book Show, and Roxanne Cody is staying with me, and my guest now, this is what I'm going to say about this nonfiction book, The Fame Lunches by Daphne Merkin. Riveting. I found every reason to read just one more of her essays, which are sometimes profiles of the well-known, I would say the wounded birds who've shared our lifetimes, Princess Diana, Mike Tyson, Marilyn Monroe. In the hands of Daphne Merkin, who's a brilliant analyst, these are nuanced, perceptive, I guess psychographs is what I call them, deeply personal. Merkin, when it fits, is candid about the challenge in her own life, depression, the struggle with her family, even fantasizing about murdering her parents. There is so much going on in any given paragraph in these essays. You don't know where to look at the subject, at Merkin, her extraordinary ability to write, whether this book might also have been called Rescue. The real people in The Fame Lunches are reconsidered in Merkin's hands, and I don't know how you can't be grateful for this. Nobody gets off easy, but they are each more human for her look, as we are as we read it. And we might find ourselves regretting the delicious media hype, the snap judgment, the cheap psychobabble we're all engaged in. There's a lot of psychological analysis of each of the human subjects. As if, and I thought to myself, what is it? What's the feel that I get about this? And it's as if Merkin sat down with a really treasured analyst, and they decided in wonderful conversation with each other, what is it about this person? And then I realized that, no, probably Daphne Merkin has had enough therapy in her life that she can do this very well all by herself. And right or wrong, she makes these profile essays have the feel of a kind of surgical precision. And it's as if you had this blade that is clearing away the flesh and behavior so that the reader can see the heart and contemplate how it beats and what it's made of. She writes about other things too, lip gloss and handbags and cultural moments. She is the Bronte sisters make an appearance. Daphne Merkin is a former staff writer for The New Yorker and author of several books, including The Hitler Diaries, a contributor to many magazines. Book clubs, I want to say, as I welcome her, I would run and get this book if you want to have a rip-roaring conversation in your book club. Daphne Merkin, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm very glad to be talking to you, and I'm very appreciative for what you said. Just to make one correction, the collection of essays before this one, although I see why you said The Hitler Diaries, is called Dreaming of Hitler.
Oh, geez. I'm so sorry. You're absolutely right. I just kind of made that up.
I thought I sounded even, there was a lot of protest when I called it Dreaming of Hitler. So I can imagine what would arise.
I know. I'm so apologized.
No.
Okay, so let's go to the essay on Princess Diana. When she died, I remember I was up very late that night and the news bulletin comes across the TV screen. And my head, I was really pacing up and back and forth across the room with my head in my hands saying, no,
right.
This cannot be.
Me too.
Yeah. So the next morning I go to a cafe with a crowd of people and there's this guy who's I think prides himself on being a lefty and quite a number of women at the table. And he laced into us for being as upset as we were. As if we were a band of sentimentalists. And,
right.
You made me think of all that, and I think there's something about that that you're getting at. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, no, it's interesting to me. I think for many people, I assume for this lefty guy, as you called him cutely, the fact that she was part of what we look upon supposedly, enlightenedly as an outdated institution, part of royalty, lived this sort of glossy, glittery-looking life. I think for that, if you have that outlook on her, that grit on her, then you're being a sort of patsy for going along with the feeling that this is a tragedy. But I think what was unique about her, more than anything else, was that she did manage to get to people on a very personal level. I don't think the response, the heartbreak, when you said you were pacing, I remember feeling exactly the same way. I think I burst out crying, which wasn't so usual for me. But I thought, oh, this is just, an utterly tragic ending to a fairly difficult, for all its photogenic quality, a fairly difficult life. And I think she got people, again, for that. Someone said to me, why are we fascinated by a Marilyn Monroe? I would say a similar fascination extends to someone like Princess Diana, who looked, quite very beautiful, who seemed to have it in quotes all, whatever we interpret all to mean, and yet seemed relentlessly troubled, looking for some kind of consolation in her life.
There's something about the people that you turn to in the book where it begins to strike me that everybody is trying to construct life anew.
Yes.
And I so appreciated that, and it reminded me of a scholar who came in once who was at a Catholic university, and he decided to do the lives of the saints, the real lives
right.
of the real people, and said that, you know, back in those days, saints were chosen not because they were perfect people, but because they had failed disastrously. They were murderers and thieves and racists and rapists.
Right.
And that they had then made their lives new and whole and become, you know, incredible people.
Right.
And it was so staggering as a thought to me. And I think I hear something of what you're getting at with this.
You know,
right.
Things I wonder about, Daphne,
yes.
is... Do you think people felt protective of people like Marilyn Monroe and Princess Di, or voyeuristic?
What was the first word felt?
Protective.
Interesting. Both. I think with those kind of figures, where there's a true larger than life because they are famous and photographed and beautiful and sexy and all those sort of media-ready aspects, there has got to be some voyeurism.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if it's the... But I think it's not only voyeurism. It's the... Then comes in the protective angle that sort of the way you'd feel about looking on someone who's sort of coming apart in the glare of the headlights, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. Let me just say, this is Daphne Merkin, and I have just fallen in love with this book. It's called The Fame Lunches. And a collection of essays by her that they're just extraordinary. I could not put this down, and just love it. Can't recommend it more highly. So, oh, you're welcome. So let me ask you a quick question about, as you select, it's not just iconic personalities that you're selecting, but, you know, movements and trends and that you talk about. So I want to be careful, but when you, this word, subject is a curious word. I mean, I don't mean to sound like Janet Malcolm here, but it is a curious word. And I wonder if that word, do you use that idea? How distant do you have to be from someone or something to be able to understand your own feelings about it? I mean, do you think about these people as subjects?
Yeah, interesting question. I think, well, there's a difference, I think, between writing about someone who you actually haven't met, you know, as is the case with, obviously, I never met Marilyn Monroe or the Brontes or Sylvia Plath. But I think there is some qualitative difference in actually doing a profile, a live profile. But I think in order to do the profile, you ultimately, or I ultimately, have to step back because there's a need of some, like, perspective in a painting in order to frame it in a way that it would make any sense as a narrative, which all these pieces attempt to be. Requires some distancing from, as you put it, the subject. I mean, I think I found it interestingly hard to do because he had a very visceral effect on me with Mike Tyson.
Oh, yeah.
I found him, it's interesting what Roxanne said about voyeurism and protective. I mean, I think a lot of these people, of the ones I met, you know, they did produce in me some of both responses. With Mike Tyson, I felt, though, much more protective than anything else, which I wasn't expecting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I understand what part of him would bring that out in
yeah.
you. So I want to also comment on your candor. I just can't even believe it sometimes. You admit to these wrongheaded impulses. You've spoken so well and so openly about your own battle with depression.
Right.
Even in this book, The Fantasy of Wanting to Murder Your Parents,
right.
meaning your rage about them. So what I want to understand is what this kind of striking candor gives to you. What, do you understand yourself why you do that or why you have this strong impulse?
Yeah, I think I do. I mean, it's something I've thought about. And when I was putting the book together, I was horrified is too strong a word, but I was reading the piece on money that I put in the book that I wrote for The New Yorker. And I
yeah.
thought, wait, I wrote this while my parents were alive? What was wrong with me? That I think I very early on, partly because of the kind of family I grew up in, partly some other factors, I very early on took against secrets. And I still have this feeling that secrets empower the powerful. Secrets aren't useful to the weak. Mm-hmm. Now, that may be a cockamamie theory of my own, but it's empowered who believe in secrets. And I sort of feel like, for me, one of the ways sort of out of what I thought was the complex and somewhat toxic structure of my family was to sort of go outside and not shout it into the air, but the way we always, you know, family, it all begins in family life where everything, you know, the whole expression, dirty, what is it, dirty laundry?
Mm-hmm.
There are so many, I mean, I think in some ways we are open as a culture, but in many ways, ancient cultural, social prohibitions stay in place. So about something like depression, I just was talking yesterday with someone how it remains a stigma.
Mm.
It doesn't matter that it's now discussed in terms of, in clinical terms, in biological terms, in a variety of terms. Basically, people who are very depressed, I have found, keep it a secret. Not, you know, I'm not saying you the ordinary walking around daily despair that comes out in statements of I feel depressed. But I mean, if you're feeling really, there's a lot of judgment in the culture of us, you know, of depression, for instance. I think none of us are honest about money. I think we have one credo for ourselves and another credo. I mean, money produces so much animus, as well as so much, I think, envy, judgment, political judgment. It's not sorted out. It's coveted. It's despised. And I think those kind of conflicted, I guess I could say in some ways conflict interests me, and one way out of it is to air it. Thus, candor.
Yeah. Daphne Merkin. I remember saying to Nancy Horn, the psychologist we have on the show frequently, what is this inclination to save others? And she said, well, it often means that person wants to be forgiven herself or himself.
Right.
And so I wonder how that fits with you. How do you
that the impulse to save others?
Yeah, is really wanting to be forgiven. Does that make sense to you?
It does make sense to me. I mean, it's sort of it's another way, really, of saying, I suppose, in some way, if you're saving others, you're saving yourself from condemnation, from not being a good person. So in that way, it does work as a kind of forgiveness,
mm-hmm.
a kind of way out of your own sense of your own your own, you know, I can't even say the word.
Yes, yes.
Whatever I was trying to say.
Well, you know, Daphne Morgan, I'm thinking to myself, maybe the thing that is the human struggle is trying to understand what is it that each of us wants to be forgiven for.
Yeah, it's wonderfully put. I do think that is, I mean, I think there are people who don't want to be forgiven for anything. And they tend to fall into sociopathic categories. But I think it's a wonderful question that we each, it's interesting, it's a sort of, to me, a compelling question for a secular age. Do you know what I mean? I mean, most of us don't think in such specifically religious terms, I think. But in the end, the notion of what do we each want to be forgiven for would explain a lot in people's psychology. Explains what they go after, what doesn't interest them. I mean, it's an interesting way of putting what drives people.
Can I ask you, when your sentences, your paragraphs are so unbelievable. I mean, it is just so fabulously written, so smart. I mean, you just keep, I'm just going, my head is spinning as I'm reading it thinking, wow. So are you, I can hear how considered you are as a person. You know, you have, like, you're really so thoughtful about your answer and these words you're using to answer me. And I think, oh, is that what it's like for you writing? Do you have that sense sometimes that, you know, every single thing you're writing down is in granite? You know,
Well, you're asking me at a moment where I'm struggling with a piece.
How much are you suffering is what I'm...
Right. A lot. I struggle. I have this great wish to make what I write read, even if it's dense, read. I'm always thinking there's a reader out there. Are they going to understand without making it reductive? Is this going to track for the reader? So I'm always, always thinking of trying to keep it flowing in a certain kind of way while being able to say things that aren't that simple. But in answer to your question, I struggle sufficiently that I just wrote someone today and said, I think I can't figure out why I became a writer.
Oh.
I find it, to me, the odd part or almost horrifying part about writing, if you care. You know, I mean, there are people who write different kinds of ways, who write more to convey information. I mean, I'm sure you know what I mean. There are many different kinds of writers. Mm-hmm. I'm not someone, a friend of mine who used to be editor of the Book Review, Chip McGrath, used to say to me, it was he to whom I said, why am I a writer, as of this morning. He used to say to me when I did reviews for him, well, just bang it out. And I would think to myself, now, if I could bang it out, my life would be different. But I'm not a bang it out kind of writer, which isn't to say that everything is equally clotted with difficulty, but certain pieces are.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, I can see why, because you're operating, you're reading a subject. And I don't mean just a person, but whatever it is you're talking about on so many levels, there are so many threads that you have to keep track of. I wish that you must come back on sometime.
I would love to.
I can rescue you from that writing.
Okay. I would love to stay.
Thank you so much. Bye, Daphne.
Thank you so much.
You are so welcome. Daphne Morgan, who is author of The Fame Lunches, an extraordinary collection of essays you will not be able to put down. This has been The Book Show. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, recipes, anything at all at our website right now, WNPR.org. Search The Faith Middleton Show. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton. Working on my rearrange.